Accession number 32389, Mr. Heath Hunter, Reel 3. Now, could you take us through, we're talking about your time at the gradient school at Derby, flying a Tiger Moth. Could you take us through, you've got us into the air now, we've taken off. What are the controls and the instruments that you're going to rely on to guide the aircraft, well, to fly the aircraft? Start with the controls. You mentioned, started telling me, but we were cut off. Tell us, so what do you control the aircraft with?
Well, you've got a joystick, which it comes backwards, the aircraft will rise. As you push it forward, the aircraft will go down. But the stick is controlling the ailerons on the back of the plane, which tilt in different directions. If you're going up, they'll go up and you'll go up. If you go down, they'll push you down. The rudder bar controls the rudder itself, which is to keep you directionally in this where you want. And you've got elevators on the wings which assist in the turning of the aircraft. One goes up and one goes down. And all this is controlled by the stick. And you've got a blind flying panel on the aircraft, which is a standard panel. In my day, it was on all aircraft. Maybe today it's altered, but when I was flying, every aircraft you flew would have a standard instrument panel. You had other instruments as well.
What were they? What were they for? And you might not be able to remember.
One of them I remember well was a turn and bank indicator, which showed you what sort of bank you had on the aircraft. And there were two types of those. One was like a ball, and if it came out of the side, you pushed it in. You pushed the side that came out, you push it back with your foot. So it was directional. You had your airspeed indicator, altimeter, which is very important.
Tells what height.
Tells you what height, yeah. And you set that before you took off. You set it by the met man, pressure. You didn't set it by what you knew the airport was at, because it might be not on the day you took off. It might not be that. It might very close, but it could be different. So you set it on the barometric pressure, and that would be it. You could set it as you set on the aerodrome. In other words, if the aerodrome was at 1,000 feet, you could set 1,000 feet on the altar. And so when you came back, it might be slightly different. But then, of course, you could see that. Because most all your flying you did at grading school was visual.
You'd only fly in good weather.
Perfect weather. And we had a perfect summer. Beautiful weather.
Now, so what other... Do you remember anything else on the the standard instruments?
No. There were six instruments. I'm sure there were six. I don't think I've got it here.
It's all right. We'll leave it. There you go.
Bloody see it now. Instrument flying panel, that's it. Turn and bank indicator, rate of climb indicator. I don't know what that one is. That's a directional thing. And that's something else. You know, 60 years, forget.
Don't worry. Now,
but this isn't my... I've got this. This is on a...
You're looking at a Lancaster thing there.
Yeah, but I've got one upstairs, which is the Lancaster I flew on. This, my granddaughter bought me... What's the place where she lives?
Right. Let's get... So, now... Well, you've got up. You're up in the air. Now, what sort of... So how do you turn? Just tell them, because they don't know. How do you turn an aircraft then? If you were going to make
a turn to the right, I put the stick over to the right, and I push the right rudder pedal forward. That would take you into it.
That would bank the aircraft.
You might have to make adjustments as you went in. Otherwise, you might finish in a full class turn. But you take off the bank as you want. You take the bank off with a stick. Very easy. As my boss once said, he said, oh, anybody could fly an aeroplane. Of course, he used to do the Cresta run. But that's it. But he never flew an aeroplane.
Now, you were a bit of a natural... Were you a natural?
No. I was a bloody ham.
Right, okay. So that's a turn. Now, what else... So the other thing you have to do... So basically, as I understand it, at grading school, you'd take off... You'd circle round and then you'd land. Was there anything else you'd do?
That was called circuits and bumps. Oh, yes, you went and did all the things. You then went up, you take it about 3,500 feet and introduced it to a spin.
All right, hang on. Well, let's do the Yes, let's go with the spin. So how do you get out? They taught you that at grading school. How do you get out of a spin?
Well, they
first explain what a spin is, because they might not know.
Well, the spin is the plane is turning on its axis in a vertical position coming downwards, isn't it? And the recovery on that, I can remember to this day, is full opposite rudder, and then stick far forward. And you build up the speed and the plane will come out. But if you're not careful, it'll go the other way. You've got to get it off quickly when it comes out. But I remember that. But they teach you that early on because, you know, some blokes will be soloing in 6 hours. So they've got to know how to recover if they get into it. But if they were only doing the circuit, I mean, they would be in the ground before they woke up. We didn't have any fatalities at grading school.
Now, anything else you'd learn while you were flying? Recovery from spin?
Yeah, then we did aerobatics. They gave you a sample of aero. You didn't ever do them at grading school, but I got the message now. They demonstrated loops, slow rolls, roll off the top, but you wouldn't do them there.
So now take me through landing then, because landing, taking off as you described it, was fairly simple, but landing that can be simple as well, but it can be, you know, you've got to get it right.
Well, you've got to get it right, and of course, you've got to get the approach speed right. You're probably 60 miles an hour you would make an approach at, but each aircraft has a different approach, and you learn that, and that's in your head, and so you approach, and as you approach, you take off, and you then get low to the ground. You ease the aircraft back just before you ram the ground. You ease the stick back and get your wheels above, and then officially on a Tiger Moth, you then did a three-point turn. I don't think any bloody pupil ever did a three-point turn. They always did a wheeler, because when you make a three-point turn, the aircraft is fully stalled, and you could stall one at 8-10 feet up. It'd be a very unfortunate experience for you. Wouldn't be nice. So you've got to be within inches of the ground when you do that, 6 inches. Which, you in time, you get it. But most of the landings are on the wheels, and the tail then settles down. You think you've done a marvellous three-point turn. We haven't.
Three-point landing, not turn.
I mean, I'm back in the car now.
That's what I was just suddenly thinking. I was going to correct again. So a three-point landing, yeah. Mm. But how did you have trouble with your first landings?
Well, I had trouble with a lot of them. Well, not just the first one. It took me a long time before I got the hang of that. I mean, you think you're doing the thing right, but you're not. Now, and, of course, you've got to keep the aircraft, the wings have got to be perfectly level. You can't have one wing down trying to do it. You've got to have the aircraft lined up properly. But we weren't on runways. We had grass fields to land on.
Now, so that's what you're doing now. You don't have many hours to show that you're good at grading school. I can't remember whether it's 10.
The maximum you got was 12.
Now, how were you doing in your hours?
Well, at 5 hours, you had a test with a chief test pilot, maybe, or assistant chief test pilot would take you up and see how you were getting on.
Now, what were these tests like? They were to analyse your progress, aren't they?
They were just what you'd already been taught. They were deciding whether you were good enough to carry on.
And it doesn't count in your 12 hours, or does it?
Oh, it's part of your 12 hours. They don't give you anything away. And I've remembered where it was now. I was at Burnham.
At Burnham Derby?
Yeah.
Well, they can definitely find which school it was there. So what was your first test like then, the 5 or 6 hour one?
Oh, that went all right, I thought. I didn't think I'd ever fly the plane. You know, I didn't ever think they'd let me loose in one by myself. I never thought that.
So at this stage, you were still doing it almost for the fun of it.
You wanted to go on, and you were hoping that you would get on, but you might not get on.
So what did you manage to get your solo done in the 12 hours then?
I did my solo. I got to my second test, which was the 12-hour test with the chief pilot. And when he landed, he patted me on the shoulder and said, "Off you go, Hunter." I said, "Where?" I thought he meant go back to the mess. But no, he meant fly, have a do a circuit.
So you got it right at the last minute.
Really at the last minute, yeah.
Which is still good, because a lot of people fail, I believe.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
Now, what do you remember of your first solo? People say it's a memorable thing.
It was a marvel. I thought it was wonderful. Get your hands away from it. I thought it was wonderful to be take off and nobody telling you what to do. You did what you thought you should do right, and it went right. I took off straight up, climbed, did a climbing turn, did a circuit and came around. Then I had to start thinking, now, what do I do? What do I land? Speed do I land at? Lined it up, and it came down. And I will tell you this, quite honestly, I think it was the only time I ever did a three-point landing. It was perfect. And, of course, that might have used to be my exuberance, thinking how bloody marvelous it was to get back on the ground. And then and that was the last time I flew in Derby.
And that was it? You'd passed?
I'd passed my test. I could go on leave again. And
now how did you feel? Because you were now going on for training as a pilot.
That's it.
You could forget being a navigator. Now, how did you feel about that?
Well, I felt very pleased because that's what I wanted to be in the first place. When I first went to Padstow, Padgate, I'll get it right, when I went to Padgate, I went there hoping to be a pilot. And they were the ones that turned me into a navigator, which I never was. So eventually I reversed it and got onto a flying course.
Now, how long had this all taken to do the 12 hours? I mean, was that...
2 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks.
So it's still, what, June, July?
Yeah.
That sounds right to you. High summer.
Yeah, it was high summer. It was marvellous weather. It was beautiful weather.
Now, so you then went on leave, and then what?
Then I was posted to Manchester, which was a holding unit for people going overseas. And at that stage, they suddenly decided there were too many air crews. They kept doing it quite frequently.
That's at Heaton Park, isn't it?
Heaton Park, Manchester. You've had this before?
Well, I've heard people, yeah, I just remember the name. So what happened at Heaton Park?
You didn't do anything. You scrounged. I mean, there was nothing laid on for... You were officially going to be there a week, but I think in the end I was there for 6 weeks. And at the end of that time, we skived off, and they suddenly announced that to the people on camp they could go and leave. But when we came back, you can't go because you weren't here. So a week later, we went on leave. So when you got back, all your old mates were... Some of them gone, some were posted. Then I was billeted out for some more weeks. The first time I was billeted out with an old couple in Crumpsall, I remember that. And they'd obviously been told by the Air Force, you will take two airmen, you don't have to feed them, just allow them to sleep here in your rooms. So we never got to know them. The next time when I came back, I didn't go to them, I went to a woman who had three daughters, I think she had. And we were only there a couple of weeks. And then the woman in the house said the chap who was sleeping in my room, Doug Grant, she said, well, you're going to South Africa. And you, Heath, you're going to Canada. How the hell did she know? And a week later, they told us. When he arrived back with a tope in his pack, he was going to South Africa. And I went to Canada. That was the last time I saw him. I think he was killed after that.
Now, so you were told you were going to Canada.
Hmm?
You were told you. Now, when did you go out to Canada? What, do you remember what month you left?
No, but I remember the ship I was on. I was on the Andes, which was the flagship of the South American fleet. And it was carrying walking wounded, American walking wounded. Most of the walking wounded were, you know, sort of cases, that sort of case. Not normal wounds.
VD.
No, I'll be doing foot in the machine.
Right.
Yeah. Well, there were women on board. Some of their wives were going back. They also had clap. And I think there was 300 air crew went on board. And we sort of work the ship. Well, we didn't steer or anything, but I was assigned to the canteen. And so we used to go down the bowels of the ship. I didn't realize that a ship, after you got past the passenger deck, I didn't realize it was so empty and hollow, because it had nothing on board the ship except the stores. And we had to go down and collect, and those main stores we had on board were cans of peaches, which we then took upstairs and sold to your mates. So I was really on board as a skivvy, as a purser.
What was your accommodation on the ship like? I mean, were you in cabins or were you on the
No. My accommodation on the way out, they took us to this huge area, empty area, and they said, there you are, that's yours, and gave us hammocks. We will now show you how to hang a hammock. They didn't tell us how to sleep in one, though, did they? Have you ever slept in a hammock?
How did you manage the first few times?
The first night, I got into bed, and I think I was lucky, because I woke up in the morning, and I thought the ship had been deserted, empty. There was nobody there. All those empty hammocks. I was in mine. But I had stuck my feet in the corners, like this, you see? And that kept it taut. But the others put the feet in the middle. And, of course, the middle, you got in the middle, you just rolled out. And so they got so sick of climbing into the during the night, they got so sick of it, they simply slept on the floor or on the tables. And so I woke up, well, where's everybody gone? I thought the ship had been abandoned.
Were you seasick at all?
No, I wasn't. We were at a table, mess table for us at 16, and I remember second day out we had a storm, and only two of us arrived, and we had 32 eggs between us. Boiled eggs, hard-boiled eggs.
Did it get pretty unpleasant on the mess deck with everyone being seasick? Or
no, I don't think many people were seasick. If they managed to hide it pretty well. They didn't put it all over the floor. But when the joke was getting from Manchester, we sailed from Liverpool. It took them all day to get there, and it's only about 30 miles. But I think we did about 300 miles shunting backwards and forwards. Then we got on this thing, and my last, I realised it was, I knew it was Liverpool. We got on board, and then we set sail. And my last memories of sailing out of Liverpool were the Formby light and the Crosby light. And I could remember those, because George Formby and Bing Crosby were the popular blokes, weren't they? And that was the last sign I had of England. And then the next thing I saw was Dublin, all lit up like a bloody Christmas tree. In other words, if you could fly to Dublin, you just turn slightly right and you're on Liverpool. And then we sailed up the Irish Sea, and sometime after that, we were chased by a German submarine.
Now, what do you remember of that? What do you remember? What happened?
Not a lot, because they didn't tell you much. But I had it verified a few years ago by somebody who was on the same ship. But he wasn't air crew. He was a radio mechanic in the Navy, and he was going over to America for some special training. And he was involved in the tracking of this submarine. It never caught up with us. We were ahead of it, and we could do 25 knots. He could only do 20.
Were you very aware of the U-boat threat or submarine threat?
No, we weren't told anything. It got very cold once, and then the next 2 days later, we were down in the Caribbean, or near the Caribbean. It was hot. So we'd gone very much up north to get rid of him, and then we came down south.
And you're not sure what month this is? It should be about September, October.
Could well be, yeah, September. Yes, it must have been about September.
Now, so where did you arrive? Halifax or no?
We arrived in New York, where we were met by the American Red Cross, put on a train, and they gave us all a banana. No other food but one banana each. Well, of course, we hadn't seen bananas for a year, had we? Not in England. There were no bananas in the beginning of the war. There were no banana boats. We trained up from there, which I think took about 12 hours or 14 hours or something, to Moncton in New Brunswick, where we then were dumped off. Some of the blokes were very lucky. They arrived there, and the same night they were posted out onto a course. We were unlucky. We were in Moncton, and we stayed there for weeks.
Now, what were conditions like in Moncton? Because it's just another camp, really, holding camp, isn't it?
A holding camp with about 3 feet of snow. Great snow everywhere. Cold, miserable. Where we did guards, you might only do a couple of guards in your time there, but their idea of guarding was walking around the perimeter fence at 2 in the morning.
So What was it like for you then, guard duty?
Miserable. One of our chaps tried to shoot himself. By accident. It was this doctor bloke I was telling you about who diagnosed me. He was in the guard room, and there was a pistol there, and he played with it. And I wasn't patrolling, I was with somebody else, and we went off. And we were halfway around the cap, and we heard this one shot, and we thought, Christ, what has happened? And when we got back, old Jimmy was sitting there with a gouge, took a lump of his hair out, but he picked the pistol up, and somebody had loaded it. And he, you know, I'm going to get out of this thing, pull the trigger. And he survived.
Now, so what were you doing? What were conditions like at the camp in this snow?
We didn't do anything. We just sat around. I mean, they were there. They were a holding camp in the sense that they'd have you there, and officially they'd be getting all the time demands for people to be posted, but we weren't posted.
Did you have much contact with the Canadians?
No, not at all.
So it's just nothing happening, really.
We went downtown occasionally. Another thing we didn't get, of course, we were still paying British income tax. When we were overseas, we shouldn't have done that. That money, extra money, should have been ours. And so once a week, you could go down to, I think it was called Dixon's, which was a pre-runner of McDonald's. But they sold poached eggs on toast. And for a treat, that's what you'd have. Because the food was not particularly good. Well, the food was English cooks. I've got to make the difference. When you get onto a Canadian station, you get fed like a Canadian. When you're on any English station, even in Canada, they do their best to make the food as bad as they can, equal to what you get at home. But if you go on a Canadian station, you start off with your...
We'll wait till we get there. So anything else happened while you were at Moncton?
Not at all. Not a thing happened.
So when do you think you left there? How long were you there about? This is just guesstimates, and we know, but...
I was there about 6 weeks, I'm sure.
So through to November-ish?
I'm sure I was there at Christmas.
Oh, right through to Christmas?
Yeah, I'm sure I was there at Christmas. Sure. Because I suddenly found one of the cookhouse staff was the lad that used to live next door to me. Never saw him again.
So you possibly went out there in October then?
Yeah.
And then you were there for... Yeah. Right. So what happened then? When did you get your posting?
I was posted to... Oh, God. I'm thinking. I was posted to an elementary flying training school at DeWinton, Alberta.
DeWinton, two words.
DeWinton. This is about 12 miles outside of Calgary. The aircraft we would be flying was a Cornell monoplane, mainly Canadian built, but they did have one or two American built aircraft.
Cornell monoplane.
Yep.
Now, DeWinton Airfield, so that's near Calgary, is it?
Near Calgary.
Calgary. Yeah. Now, so what happened when you got there? What was the setup when you got to DeWinton Airfield? What's it look like?
Well,
this would be round about January 44.
Yeah. Or late December. Yeah, late December. We had the pleasure of travelling like human beings on the CPR, Canadian Pacific Railway, right across Canada.
Well, tell us about that first, because that's supposed to be quite an experience.
Yeah, well, it was an experience, because we didn't have any NCOs. You know, 20 of us were on this train. We were scattered amongst the normal population, and you had the twin seats on either side, and so at night the two seats at the bottom became a bed, and then they pulled down the same as a couch thing from above, and you had your second bed, and then they put curtains around it, and you were just like living like a human being and eating their food, proper food. That was interesting. You know, we'd now been in the Air Force over a year and hardly ever ate out. So to get on board a Supreme train was something.
Now, what happened when you got to DeWinton? What was the setup?
We were allocated accommodation.
And what was the accommodation like?
Wooden huts, centrally heated.
Centrally heated?
Oh, yeah. These big blowers in them blew all the hot air around. And it was thick snow out there at the time.
Was it better huts than the British had?
Oh, God, yeah. I was primitive. Ours were a bit of... not even plywood, were they? Ours were very thin wood over here. And what you do have to heat in England was a room four times as big as this would have one of those pot belly down stoves in. In Canada, they had these things where the heat was coming in, it was gas fired, and then the hot air was blown out, circulated. And of course, you double glazing, which we'd never heard of here at the time. And they had it was, and in the summer, they took the double glazing out and put nets up to keep the bugs out. Oh, everything was organized.
Now tell me about the food. What is the difference between British RAF food and Canadian food?
A lot. A mile. Breakfast time on a Canadian station. Now, De Winton was not a Canadian station.
Oh, sorry. Should we wait then for that?
We'll wait for that. Well, okay. The food here was just similar to what we got in England.
So, poor.
Yeah, I think they bought the poorest cuts for the English. And, of course, we had no Canadians with us. We were not... Later on, we had Canadians with us, but at this stage, we just...
What does the airfield look like? I mean, is it a busy airfield, or is it just a small training airfield?
Oh, it was a proper training airfield. It had runways. I think it had... I'm not sure whether it had two... Well, it had runways which were like a triangle. They didn't cross over each other. They were like a triangle, and so you'd fly... Depending where the wind was coming from, the runways you would use...
Now, take me through the flying training here. Well, obviously, some of it's the same.
It's all the same.
What was a Cornell monoplane like to fly then, in comparison to, say, for
Tiger Moth?
Tiger.
Well, it was just a case of getting used to it. I think it had a slightly more powerful engine. It was painted bright yellow, the same as the Moth was. Bright yellow, so they could tell you were coming. I don't think there's anything else about it.
No, was it as manoeuvrable?
Oh, yes. It was a very aerobatic little aircraft. But there was a distinction. I said earlier that they had American and Canadian-built aircraft. And we got to a stage where the American aircraft, the main spar was metal. But the Canadian ones, it was pine. And we got to the stage where... all except about four aircraft had cracked main spars. That with the wood. But the metal ones didn't ever be. So officially, you know, we'd have four lots of people flying, and there would only be four aircraft up there which were aerobatic, which they would do, what, you know, rolls, loops. And ahead of me, I think we had about eight or nine poles that they were there. They were killed doing aerobatics in non-aerobatic aircraft. Because they were quite mad.
So these ones that had cracked spars, you couldn't do aerobatics?
You couldn't do aerobatics. You could do ordinary flying. I mean, you couldn't do heavy landings, but you could do a normal flying. But the other ones, the main spars, steel spars, they did aerobatics.